Well, in John's gospel, it's the chapter before our reading, which is from chapter 8. But in chapter 7, we're told that Jesus goes up to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. And according to Jewish tradition, four 75-foot-high candelabra stood within the court of the women at the Jerusalem temple at this time. Each candelabrum had four branches. And at the top of each branch was a huge laver, a bowl, a kind of sea. And four young men bearing these big pitchers of oil would climb up ladders, and they'd fill these golden bowls, and then they'd set them alight. So you should picture something like 16 large, enormous flames leaping toward the sky from these huge golden lamps. And remember, the temple was on a hill, so the glow was a sight for the entire city and the surrounding region to see. And the light was to remind people of how God's glory had once filled this temple. And it looked forward to a time when that blazing glory would return. And it's into that scene that Jesus enters in John 8 in our gospel lesson. It's into that scene that Jesus walks and he's teaching in the court soon after this temple illumination ceremony. And standing right next to those magnificent candelabra, he declares to all who are gathered there, "I am the light of the world." Right? Those flames point to me. I am the human incarnate embodiment of that blazing glory. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. Jesus is, as the creed declares, God of God, light of light. And this light has come into the darkness, John tells us in the first chapter of his gospel. And the darkness has not overcome it or overpowered it. And to this day, this light that is ultimately Christ stands in stark opposition, right? Antithesis to the darkness which surrounds us and which often, frankly, pervades us. The problem with the darkness is not just that it's out there, it's that it's in here. Our text this morning from Ephesians 5, and this enlarges a bit on what we saw last week, where the apostle urged us to put on the new man. It turns out that putting on the new man is essentially to be clothed in the light of Christ. Right. So I want to make three points here. They're on the outline in your bulletin. Impurity, the light of Christ, and being filled with the Spirit. So first, impurity. So again, we're in Ephesians 5, beginning of verse 3. And the apostle... Now remember, these are Gentile converts. It's early in the Christian era. And there's probably a lot of confusion on the border about what they bring into their Christian existence and what they leave behind. Right? We know this from other letters that Paul writes to churches. So he begins in verse 3 by saying there's not to be even a hint of sexual immorality or impurity or covetousness among them. The three terms he uses, immorality, impurity, covetousness, or greed, are probably meant to like expand upon each other. Where immorality refers to sexual activity outside the covenant bonds of marriage, impurity is a broader term, any kind of moral uncleanness, but it has a sexual focus. And greed here probably means sexual covetousness or greed. Such behavior, Paul says, while it's common in the Greco-Roman world, is not to be practiced or even to be named among the saints. Right? And this is a radical break with the ancient culture that Christianity brings in its conception of human sexuality and the human person. These things, he says at the end of verse 3, are not proper among saints. Two things I want you to notice by this sort of seemingly innocent statement. One is, Paul assumes you're already saints. He doesn't think sainthood is some sort of status you have to achieve. He considers the Ephesian Christians to be holy ones marked apart for God. And he says this kind of behavior is not proper. He doesn't really make what you might call a moralistic argument. He makes almost an aesthetic argument. To live this way is improper. Such behavior, he says, creates an impossible dissonance with your calling in Christ. It is wholly out of accord with who the apostle says you are in the Lord. And then he adds three types of speech in verse 4, which are normally associated with sexual uncleanness: filthiness or obscenity in some translations, foolish talk, crude or coarse jesting. Filthy behavior, he's saying, is almost always accompanied and preceded by filthy speech. And language, human language, like human sexuality, is a beautiful gift from God. It is among the things which separates us from the beasts. It is to be used soberly. This obscene language, or this coarse language, is also out of accord. He says, out of place. It's not fitting. There's that aesthetic argument. It's not fitting among saints. But Paul never asks us, right? The gospel never asks us to replace something with nothing. At the end of verse 4, he says, instead of this degrading speech, let there be thanksgiving. Right? Put aside this type of talking and put on gratitude, thanksgiving. Now, there's this is not news to anybody, I hope. There's a widespread and foolish notion in our culture, especially among its elites, that Christianity is either fearful of sex or thinks it's unclean or something, that Christianity is ultimately a repressive kind of religion. Nothing could be further from the truth. Actually, Christianity is a religion of great liberation. Right? The essence of it is aiming at human liberty. And when Paul calls us to gratitude in this context, surely gratitude for the gift of covenant sexuality is in view, or at least chiefly in view. So it's important to see that for the apostle and for the whole of the tradition, Christian sexual ethics are not driven by repression or by fear, but by a desire for human flourishing and against the wreckage caused by immorality, right? A toll which, by the way, the culture just refuses to count. So grateful people, gratitude for sexuality on God's terms delivers us from fornication. That's essentially what Paul's saying, or uncleanness. Grateful people are content. They don't covet. They speak purely about the pure gifts of God. Right? Remember what Paul says in Romans 1. It's a failure to give thanks which leads to a distortion of all the good gifts we receive. Where this gratitude is absent in our lives, it is not just an absence. It's a door to all further downstream distortions. And so in verse 5, Paul issues a solemn warning. He says this. Now, this is something that would have sounded strange in the ancient world, and it sounds strange to us. He says, "For you may be sure of this." Meaning, this should not be news to you. This is something you should be aware of. Everyone who is sexually immoral or impure, or who is covetousness, that is an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Right, that's certainly a ferocious statement. It's a sharp statement. It was then, it is now. You're not going to win any popularity awards by saying that kind of thing. But that's why Paul tells the Ephesian Christians, listen, you may be sure about this. Those who engage in sexual impurity with covetous greed are idolaters, he's saying. What he's saying is they end up worshiping their own desires rather than the living God, who, of course, is to be the grand object of all our desires. They have become, as Paul says elsewhere, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Now, I want to interject something here, and I want to emphasize it. We're not talking here, it's important to get this right, about someone who falls into one of these sins and with humility and repentance seeks restoration. That's not what Paul has in view. In fact, we're not even talking about someone who struggles long with these sins. The gospel is for broken and weak failures and for sinners in general. But Paul is talking to new Christians. He's talking about people who have not really made the break from their pagan Gentile background at all and think it's okay to not make the break. Right? That's what he has in view here. Right? He's talking to people who've abandoned themselves to an immoral lifestyle, who are covetous and don't understand that they must repent of that. So he's saying, listen, you cannot mimic the Gentile world. So such a person indicates, Paul says, that they've never been sealed by the Spirit for the day of redemption. And thus they're outside the kingdom of Christ and God. And, you know, because he knows, right, this is going to seem harsh then and now. They're not going to receive any reinforcement from the culture at large. He adds in verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words. It's interesting, Paul does not often say something like that. But right here he knows he has his finger on something that it's going to be easy to, we're going to want to naturally squirm away from it. Let no one, in other words, you're not going to get reinforcement for this apostolic warning anywhere in the culture, right? Let no one deceive you with empty words, right? Because you'll hear that God is too kind, or that a loving God would never do this or never do that. Let no one deceive you, Paul says, not one person. Doesn't matter their stature or their standing or their eminence or their platform. Let no one deceive you, no one. Such people are deceivers, and their words, Paul says here, are empty words, vain words. This is why we refuse to calculate the wreckage. If you calculate the wreckage, it's hard to see what could be objectionable to Paul's remarks here. But nobody wants to tally up the dead bodies, or the diseases, or the complete wreckage, which is being rethought in some circles now, of the sexual revolution. Now, there's a handful of books and authors out there now that are saying, hey, you know, maybe this wasn't a great idea. You know, maybe 60 million dead people is not fantastic. Let no one deceive you. You see at the end of verse 6, it's because of these things that the wrath of God comes upon the disobedient. Because of these things that the wrath of God comes. I mean, the view of the whole culture is that this stuff is no big deal. I mean, it's just sex. But mark this inspired utterance. It is these things which bring the wrath of God on the sons of disobedience. This does not mean, again, that God is repressive or that he's, you know, some sort of cosmic killjoy. It's that sexual uncleanness defiles the image of God. It attacks the root of who we are as human beings, as male and female, that God in his goodness and love is jealous to guard us against it. It has a unique ability to destroy your whole life and to do it quickly. Right? Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, this is a remarkable text. Not sure I know totally what it means, but he says this, every other sin that a man commits is outside his body, but an immoral man sins against his own body. And Paul says that God will destroy those who without remorse continually determine to destroy his temple, which your body is. It's an assault on the holy temple dwelling of God in a unique way. What's behind this is a high and a sacred and a holy and a grand and a glorious view of human sexuality. You need a degraded view to treat it as nothing. So, verse 7 then, he concludes, he tells us plainly, do not be partakers with them. Do not participate in the sexual permissiveness of the culture. Sever yourself from it completely. The second point then is the light of Christ. That's impurity. The second point is Christ's light. And here I want you to see the gospel. Because this text has the gospel right in the heart of it. Verse 8 says, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. That's the declaration. He doesn't say, listen, if you can clean yourselves up a good bit, you will be light in the Lord. He just declares to the Ephesian Christians, you were darkness, now you are light in the Lord. You are the light of the world, right? Jesus, who stood there and said, I am the light of the world, says to his disciples, you are the light of the world. You were pervaded by and you were enslaved to darkness. Now you are light. You're irradiated by the light of the one who stood in the temple under the 16 blazing torches and declared that he is the light of the world. Therefore, we are to live as the children of light. The gospel gives you everything before it demands or commands anything. It's really important to get right. The gospel gives you everything before it commands anything. It says, you are light, now be light. Otherwise, this would just be another moralizing lesson on how you have to double down and try harder. There's an announcement here. You are light. The text doesn't say, listen, try and clean up some of the dimness in your life. It announces your light-bearing, light-giving character. Augustine famously said to God, give what you command. That's interesting, right? God gives what he commands. When he says, you are light, therefore live as light, that's the command. God gives the grace even for that. He gives what he commands, and therefore, Augustine said, command what you will. Give what you command what you will. And as light, then, we're told to try and discern what's pleasing to the Lord, right? To discern his will. And the first thing that entails, of course, is to take no part, it says here, in the unfruitful works of darkness. You know, among the other things about these works of darkness is that they're unfruitful, Paul says, meaning they're barren. Right? They're not acts of liberation. And again, the exhortation is stark, have nothing to do with them. What fellowship, Paul asks rhetorically in 2 Corinthians, what fellowship has light with darkness? So clearly the answer is none. We are people who, having died with Christ and having died to the world and having been raised with Christ, are then, Paul says in a couple different places, right? He says, we are then people who are to present our bodies, our very members, to God as alive from the dead. Present your instruments as weapons of righteousness to God. Do not present them to sin. Because you're already died and you're already raised. So we're not only to flee these works. Paul actually says we're to expose such works. For it's shameful, he says, to even speak about these things in secret. Now this might on occasion call for denunciation. But Paul's not running around in the culture. It's clear to understand this. It's very important to understand this, right? He's not running around in the culture denouncing all these things, right? His main accent here is that we expose these things simply by being what we are, by being light. Again, you are the light of the world. There's no commandment that says you should manufacture some light in your life. There's the declaration. Now, Paul's much more concerned about... Now, the stuff's in the world. He, of course, doesn't approve of it. And he's willing to expose it. But his focus is on the church. Remember what he says in 1 Corinthians? He says, when I told you not to associate with immoral people, I didn't mean immoral people out in the world. Otherwise, you'd have to leave the world to do that. He says, I meant in the church. He says, what do I have to do with judging people outside? So Paul's not, like, condemning the whole world here. He's just saying you can't live that way. So verse 13 says, all things are exposed by the light and they become visible. That's just what the light does. It illumines. It illumines by exposing. And that's really not even meant to condemn, right? The exposure, the illumination, is meant to transform, to liberate. If the room is dark and you flip the lights on, you're not trying to condemn the darkness. You want to banish it, flee from it, but you want to bring some liberation, some transformation. Look at the end of verse 13. It says, the things which the light illumines themselves become light. Right? The idea, again, is that transformation comes by shining forth the light that we are in Jesus Christ. You've been translated from the realm of darkness into the domain of light. So let that light shine forth. This does not make us moral scolds or self-righteous people. You know, we're people who shine forth the light. We try to do it in a winsome way, in a humble way, in a broken way. But the light banishes the darkness. It transforms it. Look at verse 14. Paul illustrates this by quoting. This is a remarkable text. This looks to be a very early Christian hymn adapted from the book of Isaiah, right? He says, "Awake, O sleeper, and rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you." There is a command right there to wake up and rise from the dead, because you are already awake, and you are already risen, and you are already light. This, you know, I was looking at this week, and I thought, here's the original primal form of wokeness. Right? This is Christian wokeness. If to be woke means to be awake to the way things really are, this is the then it's a perfectly legitimate concept. Because people do sleepwalk through life. They're not awake. Right? So Paul is saying, wake up! He's trying to wake us up. He's trying to raise us from the dead. Awake, O sleeper, and rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. That's a lot different than, hey, try a little harder. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. He's saying, you've died with Christ and you've been raised with Christ. Wake up. Let the light of Christ shine on you. We are to awaken ourselves and those who slumber in the darkness. So that's the light of Christ. The final point is being filled with the Spirit. Now here there are some commands. But again, remember, the gospel doesn't command anything until it's already given you everything. Please get that. The gospel does not command anything until it gives you everything. So be filled with the Spirit. Verse 15, look carefully then how you walk. Let's stop there for a second. Look carefully how you walk. Right? The Christian life is a thing of utmost seriousness. It's not, you know, there are two extremes here, right? A morbid hyper-carefulness and an easy casualness. Both are not Christian. Right? There's the casual Christian that doesn't seem to pay any attention to the sobriety or what they're up against. And then there's the morbid hyper-careful Christian, you know, the earnest scold. That person. You don't want to be either one of those people. But you want to look carefully to how you walk. You don't want to be stumbling around carelessly. Right? Whatever we are serious about, we take great care with it. Right? And it's a tragedy to see people who are more serious about taking care of their cars. Right? Or manufacturing their, or you know, manicuring their lawns. Or cultivating their hobbies than they are in curating their souls. That's the problem we want to avoid. That's a lack of order and proportion. So be careful, Paul says. Watch yourselves. Right? Don't be scared. We're not scared. We're just alert. Right? We're not scared, but we are alert. Be careful. Watch yourselves. There are dangers everywhere, right? We're not paranoid. We're not paranoid, but we just recognize the world for what it is. What we are is sober realists. Now, such a disposition in verse 16 leads us to make the best use of the time. Or some translations say to redeem the time. You wouldn't think you'd have to do that, but it's important to get this, right? The mere fact that we have trouble with time is a sign that time itself is under the fall. Like, time is a creature. Time's not a neutral thing. Right, so we run out of time. I'm late for this. We only have so much time for that. We're always struggling with time. Maybe we allotted too much time for a task. We're always in this wrestling match with time because it creates difficulties for us because time is itself fallen. Paul can say that the days are evil. He says it right here in this text. He doesn't say the days are neutral. He says the days are evil. Monday's evil, Tuesday's evil, Wednesday's evil, all the days. They're evil. They're marked, if you will, he's saying, by sin and by death. Sin and death scar all human time. Thus Paul can say in Galatians 1, God gave his Son to deliver us out of this present evil age. Right. Yes, we have lots of conveniences and all sorts of things to buffer us from this, but nevertheless, the age is evil. Still, though it's fallen, though it's crumbling, time is a gift of God. Even in all of its fragility and even in all of its ambiguity, it's an irreplaceable resource. And yet we often behave as if we have an infinite amount of it. Right? We secretly seem to think we will live forever. But people walk around like they're like inscribed on Mount Rushmore, you know, like they're like permanent fixtures of the earth. Paul is saying, listen, you have to buy back the time. You have to take the initiative with the time. You have to use it and use the opportunities God's given you well. Now, there are a lot of pitfalls here, too, of course. Before he was 20 years old, maybe the greatest American theologian, Jonathan Edwards, made a resolution. This sounds like an eager 20-year-old. Here's the resolution. Resolved, never to lose one moment of time, but to improve it in the most profitable way I can. Well, I would say that's more than a tad idealistic and even a bit complex.